If fate is a bunch of strings, then I'll carry scissors. My choices are my own. I'll make them as I please.
Welcome to the Busy Girls Book Club. We are a podcast that brings you reviews of all of BookTok's top trending books, and we tell them if a busy young professional like us should take the time to read them. I'm Catherine.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Casey. Today, we are reading a book called Six Crimson Cranes by Elizabeth Lim. And it is this very like fairy tale-esque journey of this princess Shiori. And there's lots of twists and turns. It's sort of a mashed tale between some like grim fairy tales and then some Eastern folklore. So it's like very sort of Asian inspired fairy tale-esque YA story. And it follows Princess Shiori as she develops magic and also tries to fight evil and tries to save her brothers who end up being turned into cranes. And that's the inspiration for the title, Six Crimson Cranes. Yeah, so she's got to end the curse.
It's based on Grimm's book, The Six Swans, the Grimm's Brothers fairy tale.
Which I didn't know until literally like 10 minutes ago when I was looking up reviews. I don't think I've ever read that one.
Have you ever? It's like Swan Lake adjacent.
That's what it seemed.
It's like the basis and premise for like the Swan Princess and Swan Lake, those like Disney movies.
Yeah, I also saw some reviews about some of the Asian folklore it's based off of. One of them is like, I can't remember the name, so I just skip this part. But the point is, it's like a fusion story, and it's very cool. So do you guys have your reviews ready?
Indeed. I can go first. I'm just going to read like the first two sentences of this review because every review I found was like a deep dive into the book. Mm-hmm. But this is a 4-star review from Goodreads from Maisha. This book is the definition of supreme chaotic fun. If someone asked me to describe Six Crimson Cranes in a word, I would choose eventful to do so.
I agree with that. I can go next. So this is a 3.5-star review. Also, I just want to say this book has really good ratings, but like half of the 4-star reviews I saw were actually 4.5 stars. So I think if you could count like half points, the reviews would actually be even better. Anyway, 3.5 stars. All it says is, thank you, Elizabeth Lim, for creating Seryu.
I love it. I will say my review is from StoryGraph, and you can do point whatever on StoryGraph. It's still a 4.24 stars. But my review is a 4-star review I found from StoryGraph from user Bug Fiend. And it says simply, more dragons, less bowls. Which you'll get when you read the book, but
yeah,
can't say I disagree.
Yeah, fair enough. So the Goodreads rating is 4.2 out of 5. The Amazon rating is 4.6 out of 5. How do you guys feel about that?
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's a good sweet spot.
Yeah, I'm almost exactly on par. I rated this book quality rating 4.5 stars. I really loved this book. I love fairy tales, and I think anyone who loves fairy tales will love this book. I had like 2 main critiques, which we can, you know, get into whenever.
Yeah, I think we have similar critiques because, of course, I spoiled myself and saw your Goodreads review. I also gave it a 4 stars, but I was teetering on like 3.8 to 4 stars for similar reasons as I think we're going to get into later. I just had a couple of critiques, and it's a YA book. And sometimes I forget that when I'm reviewing and like critiquing books, is that this was not made for me. this was made for someone younger than me, and I have to like give it a little grace in that sense. So I'll say 4 stars just because.
I don't know what you're talking about. It was made for me. I gave it 5 stars. We all know I'm a sucker for a good high action fantasy novel, especially if it's based on fairy tales. And reading it from like the perspective of a YA book, oh my gosh, I would have destroyed this even harder when I was in my like YA actual age range. I have critiques and stuff, but like overall, I enjoyed it. I'd recommend it. It was a good quick read. 5 stars.
Yeah, so maybe we should just start getting into it now. We've talked about this before on the podcast when we've read YA before. Some YA is written for 18-year-olds and some YA is written for 13-year-olds. And the difference is pretty stark. So sometimes reading YA can be really jarring. The main character, Shiori, is supposed to be 17, and I think she reads like she's like 13, and that is like my biggest critique, because I think the story is so beautiful. It's so winding. There's so many like changing of plans and things fail and like new like obstacles are put in the way. Like I thought it was amazing, but that main character is not 17. Like this is like a 13-year-old YA novel.
See, I could kind of believe she was 17 just because of her sheltered life. So she just seemed like a sheltered 17-year-old, because I've met some 17-year-olds that are very immature and I could totally see it. she doesn't know the world very well. She's immature. She doesn't know what to really like. She doesn't have street smarts at all. So you're just kind of like, what are you doing?
Because it's like, for me, I compare it to like Shadow and Bone, which is the last YA we read. Shadow and Bone felt like it was written for 17-year-olds. This book just does not feel like it's written for 17-year-olds.
I agree that I feel like it's written for younger YA. There is romance in the book, but it's like, he looked at me. Well, he...
Yeah, it's like your first...
He leaned in.
Yeah, so like, wholesome. Or hands touched, you know, that kind of thing. It's cute.
Yeah,
but you know, like Shadow and Bone, written for 17, the romance is a little steamier to the point you're like, oh, are they gonna? But I agree with Catherine. Like, I wasn't upset with her character being immature because I feel like it's because she's a spoiled princess who had never left the capital city or really the palace and had a lot to learn. And I think that's kind of the whole journey, is like growing her up to be what she has to be. So I wasn't mad with that. But along those lines, let's go. Is it more plot or character driven? Is Shiori the driver or the plot?
The plot.
She's not the driver at all.
She's a victim of the plot. Like,
yeah,
110%.
It's her fault, but the whole story is against her will.
Yeah, she falls victim to other people's like plans and just stumbles into them accidentally and then suddenly has a bowl on her head.
Yes, and is quick to judge, which does not serve her well.
No.
Okay, so have you read other books by the author, or would you continue reading the series?
I'm already almost done with the second book. So far, my thoughts are not nearly as good as the first one, but I'm not mad about it. Like, I just love the little world the author has built, and I enjoy Shiori. And I love me a female main character whose primary goal is to eat good food.
Preach.
Like, talk about realistic. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I have also not read other books by the author. I do want to read the sequel. However, I'm a little nervous too, because the first book like leaves off a small cliffhanger for the second book, but it also ties up very well. So I'm just feeling so satisfied with the first book that I'm like, I don't know. The only thing, the reason I would read the second book is because I want there to be more dragons. which is my only other critique of this book, is that the dragons should have been more important.
Okay, well, I've yet to be determined if they're very important in the second book.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
There's more of them, for sure.
Yeah, that was my critique, too, is because... And we'll get into the spoiler. I'm not going to spoil it because it is a spoiler and it's like the ending of the book. So I'm not going to get into it. But there's like the ending part. It kind of leaves open a door in which I'm a huge not fan of the trope that they're heading towards. So that's why I'm really hesitant to get into book two. And we've discussed it on other episodes of this podcast, but we'll discuss it again later. So I also have not read any of her other books, but I kept seeing them pop up in reviews going through Goodreads, and like Spin the Dawn is her debut series, which everyone said it's like their favorite series from Elizabeth. And then I also saw that she does Twisted Disney Tales retellings, so I thought that was interesting. I don't necessarily think I'll read them, but
I've seen those like on the shelf at the store. Never put two and two together that those were hers. So that was something I was pleasantly surprised to see too. And I think they're pretty popular with a certain audience, YA audience. And I think like if I was in middle school or whatever, I would have picked that up definitely.
Yeah, that's definitely the middle school audience.
I agree. I think she probably would have been my favorite author if I was 15. But unfortunately, I'm 24, and while I did love this book, I'm not hungry for more YA.
Okay, what about the pacing?
Okay. I thought the pacing was pretty good.
Yeah.
I was like, why is no one saying anything? I thought it was fine.
I slammed through the book. Every time I felt like it was stretching on a little too long, the author changed it up. So it was like every time I was just reaching the point where I was like, okay, I've had enough, it was different. So it was like, it was just perfect.
Yeah, the chapters were nice and short. So, because like I have a Kindle, so I read it on the Kindle and it said like it takes less than 10 minutes each chapter to read it. So that's what I kind of was like, okay, I can read one more chapter because it's only going to take 6 minutes. It's only going to take 7 minutes. And then I finished the book in one night. I started it at 8 p.m. and finished it at midnight.
Okay, so. I didn't read it that fast. I never do, Catherine. But I think I read it over like maybe like 3 days just when I had time, but I didn't want to put it down. Katie's right. Like whenever it lags a little and you're like, then something happens in the plot. You're like, ooh, now I'm interested again. So kept me tied into it. Not crazy Catherine style, but it did.
See, this is why I answer the question after y'all, because I know you're gonna roast me.
I feel like when I say it took me longer, I feel dumb, but like I'd be like a normal human.
Yeah, I actually think it took me 4 days to read, but I read it when I was traveling. And so the book I read before this was Babel, so like I read Babel on the plane. And then I read this book like while I was sort of like going through cities, so I just didn't have as much time to read it. But I think if I was just like in my normal life, I probably would have read it in 2 or 3 days. Like Caitlin said, I really didn't want to put it down. I was just busy, but it was easy to pick back up. So
would you turn on a TV show or a movie based on this book?
It would make a good movie.
I would love to see this world brought to life in a movie. I just think it's so beautiful and like it's the perfect mix of like dark, sublime, but also just like beautiful, gorgeous, picturesque countryside. And all the food and like the outfits and the dragons. Like, I think it just has potential to be a really beautiful movie.
I think it could even, you know, it gives me almost Pixar vibes. Like, it could be very Pixar-y and sweet, that kind of way. I would watch it. I would love to see it, like you said, come to life. I think I'd love to see it animated.
Yeah.
I don't hate that. I like it. I think that would be good.
Like, almost traditional, like, anime style. animation.
Yeah, well, that's what one review I read said. This is like written Studio Ghibli. I was like, yes. Like, give me some Kiki's Delivery Service style stuff here.
That's what it makes me think of, Howl's Moving Castle.
Yes, someone else said that too.
Yeah, and how it's just all this like gorgeous magic and like wholesome like vibes.
Yep.
All right. Well, that brings us to the Busy Girl rating. What are y'all giving it?
I have to give it a 5. I mean, it took me less than a day.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm also going to give it a 5. I just think it's a great story. I'm someone who doesn't even really enjoy YA, and I was really pulled into this book. And it's super easy to pick up and put down. Like, there's nothing to hate.
I'm going to agree with the 5, especially if you like fantasy in any capacity. Like, this is just a perfect little package tied up with a bone dropped on your doorstep. There's no reason not to read it if you're a busy girl who likes fantasy. And like Casey said, you don't even have to like YA. I think it's just a nice little story. I told my mom to read it. My mom reads no fantasy books at all, but I was like, Mom, you should read this. I think you'll think it's really cute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd give it to my mom, but it's actually way too wholesome for her. So
I almost wonder if my mom would enjoy it, but she also reads a lot of highbrow literature, and this might just be like too slow for her.
Are you guys like backhandedly insulting my mother?
No.
Not. I'm insulting my mother. I'm like, she can't read a book this nice. She's gonna listen to this and text me. She's gonna be so mad.
She's gonna read it out of spite.
Yeah, I'm kidding, Mom. I think she would like it. I actually think she would read it and then recommend it to her students who are sixth graders.
Oh, for sure.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you have like little nerds like we were who can read this level in like third, fourth, fifth grade, I'd highly recommend it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a good, there's nothing like inappropriate at all in it.
It's a good starter novel.
Horribly violent for a fantasy book. I feel like Harry Potter has more violence.
Yes. Harry Potter also has more like sauciness as they get older. This book is like a hold your hand kind of romance.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that, I think we are ready for our spoiler alert section. If you haven't read the book, go read it. It's really cute. And then come back and listen to the rest of the podcast.
And Google what a crimson crane looks like so you know what you're picturing the whole book.
I would like to thank the cover of the book for helping me out. Yes,
please, really.
Okay, first up, what did you think of the setting? There's a lot of East Asian influence, like we mentioned before, kind of mashed with the grim fairy tale, the Six Swans.
Yeah, I mean, I know this story from Grimm has been retold a lot of times. You don't think of it as much as like the really, really popular ones like Rapunzel and Cinderella and Snow White. Like, it's not been a Disney remake, really. So you don't think of it as like a popular one. But then I like thought back on it and I was like, oh, there's so many retellings of this. This was my favorite retelling of it because it has like a lot of familial influence. It's got magic. It's got dragons. It's got like this really importance and honor of family to it that I thought was, that really made it perfect. It's not a romance. It is a romance, but it's not just a romance.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. I was actually about to say it's a story that hasn't been Disney-fied yet, so it's like much less recognizable to us, but I thought it was wonderful. Like, I really believe this author created such a great world that is so fascinating that you really just are kind of along for the ride, and all of these beautiful twists and turns. Like, I'm sorry, the bowl on her head, I loved that. I loved the food. I loved the reliance on family and the sort of like inspiration from Asian like festivals and practices. It just felt very rich and real. And so I thought it was great.
Yeah, I also loved the setting. Especially, I just felt like you could see every piece of food she picked up, every kite flying through the sky, like every lantern. Like, it was so beautifully written that I, like, you couldn't not love the setting. You just wanted it to come to life. And I think the East Asian influence lent perfectly to this story. I wasn't familiar with the fairy tale in general, but like this just, you know, felt like something you would tell your kid before bed or something. Like it was, it was cute. I'm going to say it a million times. It's cute.
Yeah.
And at first, at first I was worried because the writing is very simple. It's very easy to read. And at first I was worried it was going to put me off. Like I was like, this is just a little too elementary. And then you just kind of get into it and it really matches the characters and it matches the story and you just sort of like get pulled in. And it was like, this was the right choice because anything else would just not fit what she's built.
Yeah, I saw a review and I think it really spoke to it where the reviewer, it was a 3-star review of this book, was talking about how it takes her a little bit to get into YA books because it's like almost a mental shift change from adult into YA in the language. And she said it took her about 80 pages, but once she got past those 80 pages, she was in. And I think the author does really well using simple descriptive language. So like, even though a fifth grader could read this book really easily, you imagine the world because she's using that simple language just to describe everything really beautifully. You don't need fancy language.
Right. I think it's timeless. I think it's ageless. Like, I think it's just a very general, appealing book setting.
Okay. So the protagonist, Shiori, ends up having magic, which is forbidden in her father's kingdom. She starts off kind of small with the beloved character Kiki, and then kind of learns how to do more and more with the help of the little dragon boy. What did you guys think of the magic in the book and her relationship to it?
I will say every aspect of this portion of the plot is predictable. You know what's coming, you know it's gonna get her in trouble. But I still liked it. Like, there was plenty of other nuance that came with the story that I didn't mind that was predictable. And I love that, you know, she just kind of held this key to shaping a new world within the kingdom. Like, there's adventures in this layer she is peeling back, and it was really cute.
Yeah, I loved Kiki, of course, and the fact that she could talk to this paper crane and that it came to life. But I love the aspect of like that her magic is the idea that she takes part of her soul to reanimate objects or to grow things and create things. It's not magic for the sake of magic. It's like it has an explanation of like it takes a part of your soul, a piece of your soul to create life almost. And I really loved kind of that aspect. I think it was a little bit glossed over because it's not an adult fantasy book that would delve really deep into like the fracturing of your soul by doing all these things. But, you know, take what you get. It was nice.
She's a horcrux. Just kidding. Yeah. Sorry, that's what your comment triggered in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah. In reality, if we're going back to the Studio Ghibli comparisons, the Shiori Kiki relationship gives me funny the main character in the other one, Kiki's delivery service, Kiki's cat Gigi, this little black cat that like she can hear talk and no one else can, and it's their little like sidekick in learning magic, gives me major Kiki's delivery service Studio Ghibli vibes.
Yeah, I'll agree with you guys. Also, maybe we think something we should talk about is that this book is not always the most unpredictable. I don't think that's where you like derive the enjoyment of reading this book. It's more about just sort of watching the journey happen. But like the the quote unquote plot twist with her stepmom, very predictable. Her relationship with magic, you know, it's going to get her in trouble. She's going to be sent away, very predictable. Like, even her stepmother ending up being not a villain, I found kind of predictable. Her actually liking her betrothed, predictable, which sounds like it's going to be a bad book, but it's really just like creating this sort of story that it's like, it's not about the twist. It's about sort of just reading the development.
Yeah.
And there's lots of unexpected things in the plot that happen, just not the major points.
Well, and I think that's because it's a retelling of a fairy tale. And that's kind of the points the fairy tale has in common. Not exactly, of course, but that's, I mean, if you're going to do a book that has predictability to it, I think basing it off of an already established story gets, you can get away with it a bit more. And I think that's where this book does really well, is it takes an already told story, and even though you know the plot of it, you can enjoy the ride through it.
So true. Cinderella always loses her shoe, you know?
Yep.
So another sort of predictable aspect of the storyline is, and it kind of goes with, you know, ancient, you know, royal culture. Shiori is 17, which means she's marriageable age for, you know, alliances and things for the kingdom. So she is betrothed, and the book kind of starts out, she's headed to her betrothal ceremony. She's all dressed up, and then she dips. She chases her paper bird, jumps in the lake, and almost dies. And I mean, what do you think about her reaction? Would you also jump in a lake if you were 17, set to be betrothed?
Maybe not jump in a lake. I would definitely try to get out of it, because I'm sorry, we've already said this. She does not read 17, and it's just icky to think about her getting married, honestly.
Yeah. She's a literal child. Like, I know all 17-year-olds are children and none of them should be getting married, but this girl is like truly a child. And I felt the same. I was like, the idea of her just being married off and having to do adult marriage, like things, like, and not even just, you know, a sexual relationship and being a mom, but like being like a figurehead of a kingdom. I was like, absolutely not. Like, this girl is like in need of some character development big time, which comes, but I agree. I think I would flee. Not sure jumping in a lake would be my like first idea.
I will say this is one of the points that I don't want to say like confused me, but so my thought was, okay, she's the youngest of the seven children and she's 17, and her other brothers are not, her brothers are not yet married off. Like, one of them's promised, I think, at this point, the oldest. I'm like, why aren't they betrothed, you know, for alliances? Why is the 17-year-old final child the first one to be married off? I don't know. Like, I understand, you know, kingdom, girls versus boys, blah, blah, blah. But I was like, okay, so potentially this brother of hers is like 30 and just bopping around.
I mean, to me, part of it was that the boys were also like serving in the military. And so they were like able to support their kingdom. And like, you know, it's often more socially acceptable for men to be married much older, whereas like women aren't seen as like being able to contribute. So they're just shipped off.
Yeah, their contribution is marriage.
Yeah. I do want to say, though, this is a part in the book that I think back on and it just makes my heart like flutter because it's so wholesome, because it's the fact that it's, I think her name is pronounced Raikama, but I'm not totally sure. The fact that she orchestrated this match makes me feel so good, because you end up finding out that he's this really great guy and he's actually a great match for Shiori, and like his kingdom is beautiful and she would have been supported. And so I was like, Raikama was actually trying to do her a huge solid in being like, out of all the people in the world who are like going to be thirsting after you, like, this is the best case scenario. And the fact that she really fought for that and set that up made me just like love her so much.
And like, it was a match that wasn't looked, it was looked down upon by the rest of the kingdom. Like, why would you marry her off to some northern warlord kind of thing?
I did like the overall sort of thematic undertone of like, you don't always appreciate what your parents decide for you or make you do, but almost always your parents' best interest is at the heart of it, or like your own best interest is at the heart of your parents' decision. And you kind of start to get the little nuggets as Shuri is cleaning up her mess about like, oh, Rikima did this for her. Oh, she did this for her. And it wasn't even her like blood child. She just loved her a lot. And it was really cute. It was. I'm sorry. I need to find another word besides cute. I keep saying.
No, I agree. I love the thing, the themes of both like your relationship with your parents and also being quick to judge. As I stated earlier, Shiori thinks she knows everything. She's not even like, part of her distaste is that she's being married in general, but also a huge part of it is that she knows she's being married off to someone who's not considered influential, who doesn't have this like sought after land and like prestigious status. And she's really snobby about it. She's like, ew. And then she just, that's one of her biggest points of character development, is learning that like there are more important things.
Yeah, this girl is judgy and she knows nothing.
Yeah.
She is judgy.
That which is also not her
fatal flaws.
Yeah, they keep her so naive. But anyway, so one of the biggest points that sort of sets all the plot off is that Shiori meets this dragon boy. He saves her life and then ends up teaching her magic. What did you think of Seryu, if that's how his name is pronounced?
I loved their little meeting at the festival and how they were fighting over food. I was like, yep, you know, this is going to be a good character. I enjoyed Seryu. I thought it was a very wholesome little friendship, and also how it kind of gave her butterflies was very like, once again, it sounded like she was 13, but still, like, she's never interacted with it. He's magic, blah, blah, blah. But I thought he was fun. I thought he challenged her in a kind of good way. This is one of my few complaints about this book, is in the middle of the book, I was like, so why did we meet the dragon? I was like, I don't get how he's relevant to most of the book. He comes back and, you know, he helps her and stuff. But I was like, I thought there were going to be more dragons based on the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, because I saw reviews where people are like, I am in love with him. And I'm like, I could see myself being in love with him if he had a more prominent role in this book. But he does not. And he just kind of disappears. And then you're just left with questions of like, if he can just pop up into other water sources, why not?
I felt the exact same way. I really liked him when he was there. I found him a really intriguing character, and actually one of the more interesting characters in the book, which made me want to see more of him, obviously. And it did feel a little useless that he's there, because the things he contributed could have been achieved other ways without adding a new character. Also, Catherine, what I believe you were referencing is I am terrified that they're setting up a love triangle. It really feels like that. And I'm really torn because I actually really like her betrothed, and I think he's really good for Shiori. But also, Seryu is like very interesting. And so I'm not sure where it's going to go. And I feel like I'm not going to like whatever happens.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was referencing. You know how much I hate love triangles because I think they're dumb. It's also not really a love triangle. It's a love cone, because it's just two men lusting after one woman, but there's no like connection at the bottom. So it's more of a cone without like the side. Anyway, I digress.
Caleb's face.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make sense of it. Isn't that what a love triangle normally is?
Well, it's missing this side.
So what, are the men usually in love with each other?
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's a misnomer. Anyway. So,
sorry, I was very confused.
No, you're good. I made it confusing. It's fine.
And I was thinking, then I was like, cone, three-dimensional. I don't get it. No. Anyway, sorry.
Okay. I'll get into it now. So I...
Should we get into it? I don't know.
No. Okay.
Your brain's scaring me at the moment.
I got it. It's coming back to me. I really think he's an interesting... Saryu is a very interesting character. And I think he's a lot like Shiori, where they're very, very similar people of like both grew up in kind of this privileged environment and don't really know a lot about the outside world. Like he kind of pretends he does, but at the same time, he's kind of... That's the first human girl he meets is Shiori. So... they're kind of learning from each other. And I thought it was a really cute dynamic, but at the same time, like people that are very the same tend to butt heads a lot. I liked Takan, her betrothed, but he felt very vanilla cookie cutter to me. And mm-hmm. so that's kind of where I have my issues. I thought he was really good for her and different, very shy, very reserved, but sees things and sees parts of her. And so he's kind of almost her perfect fit. But at the same time, I'm like, he's a little boring.
So, I like that he was boring. I was like, sign me up for that one. Yes, very practical. Thank you.
So this is why I'm conflicted, is I feel like Takan should be endgame love interest because he balances her in a way that's healthy. But I agree, part of what interests me in Saryu is that he challenges her in a way I like. And I maybe even wish that Takan would like challenge her a little more in that way. And then I would be like fully on board with him. But the fact that like, you know, normally the love interest that's introduced first is the one that does not last. Like if there is a love triangle, it's normally like the second person who ends up like being like the endgame love interest. And I'm like, I don't know if that's where this is going. I honestly can't tell, but I don't know if I support it. Like, I'm just very apprehensive.
I don't support love triangles, period. So
I don't either. I'm like, we didn't need it. We didn't need a love triangle.
I feel like I can't say anymore because I'm almost done with the next book. And I have many, many thoughts that go beyond this discussion.
We'll talk offline. Okay, so moving on. One of the biggest points in the story is the quote-unquote evil stepmother. Obviously, this quote-unquote evil stepmother ends up actually being a good force in the book who's really trying to look out for Shiori. What did you think at the beginning? How did your views change? You know, it's not a totally unpredictable twist, but how did you feel about it?
I thought we were going Snow White for a minute. The like very beautiful stepmother that everybody loves and can't see past her beauty and wants to kill her stepdaughter. I was like, ooh, where's the huntsman? But in reality, like I love a good parent is the villain kind of story. And I love that it turned out parent isn't the villain and that she planted all these lovely memories and had her best interest at heart. And then Shiori almost came to that without having to be told that. She kind of was figuring it out, which was a big sign of her maturity. I feel like normally the character doesn't come to it on their own. Like, wait, maybe she's not doing this for bad reasons. Like, normally it's, you know, the big plot twist at the end. So I like that part of it felt very human.
Yeah, no, I think it's a complete reversal of the evil stepmother trope, where the evil stepmother turned out to be a complicated family parental figure. And like, yeah, she did curse her to where if she talked, her brothers would die. Like that, she did confirm, like, yes, your brothers would have died if you had spoken a word, which is not okay.
She did speak before the bowl broke.
And I know.
Die.
I know.
Sorry.
I know, but that's a weird plot hole.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the bowl was breaking, blah, 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 but...
Yeah, I totally agree. This is one of the things that I think that like would make people like my mom or other people who are parents love this book is because that's something my mom always complains about in Disney, is that the mom is either dead or evil. And so I feel like, I don't know if Elizabeth Lim is a mom, but it feels like she's a mom because I felt like it was very expertly done, like the dynamic of a teenager who sees the worst in a parent when the worst isn't necessarily the truth and has to sort of come around. You know, I feel like a lot of us go through a phase where we're very at odds with our parents and then end up realizing, like, finding more middle ground. So that felt very real to me.
I don't know. Maybe if I read it as a kid, I would have been like major eye roll at this life lesson. But
yeah,
as a 27-year-old, nowhere near having kids, but I'm like, yeah, mom was always right.
Indeed.
I want to make clear though, I'm not saying my mom was always right. She's listening.
Wow. The shade being thrown at Fiona this episode.
I'm kidding. Cut that out. I just don't want her to get too... I don't want her to get her head to get too big. She's going to like text me and be like, glad you finally came around.
I tell my mom all the time now, I'm like, yeah, you were always right.
I do too.
Still are.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. But my mom did always have my best interest at heart. So...
So along those lines, what did you think specifically of Rekima's curse for Shiori and her brothers? And I love how the curse is kind of like, you kind of feel like at the beginning you're gonna just get Shiori on this adventure, but the brothers are a part of it the whole time because of this curse. What did you guys think?
I thought the same. So the curse is the reason I originally picked this book up. I was really fascinated by the idea. You know, it's like on the, you know, the back of the book cover. I was really fascinated by the idea that she's silenced with the threat of her brothers dying. I was like, oh, that's so dark, like, and very fairy tale. Like, I'm so intrigued. And I really did like it. And I agree. I liked that her brothers end up being more in the novel than I thought, because the beginning, Shiori felt so alone. And so I'm glad that as the book went on, she was able to kind of like gather support. As for Rekima being a good person and like threatening to murder her brothers, that part is like a little bit funny.
Well, she talks about how the pearl like twists her desire to protect them.
Right. I did kind of forget about that part, which I think was like a good explanation of like, you can guide magic, but you can't really, it's not like a right. pen, it's like a wish.
Right. She like told yeah. the pearl to protect them and it was like, all right, cranes.
Which is a weird protection, but all right.
Mm-hmm. But we're gonna love
that. Yeah, I loved how it was set up with really no loopholes too. Like, mm-hmm. I kept like, oh, she'll find a way to get the bowl off her head. No, she kept that damn bowl on her head that whole time. And
yeah,
there was no loophole.
Yeah, I really liked that the brothers were more actively involved in the story. Like, I was really worried that she'll just be on that island being silent by herself and I'd be bored out mm-hmm. of my mind. But when she meets up with her brothers, I thought that was really cool. My one critique is I wish the brothers had more like singular roles or character development mm-hmm. because I felt like I couldn't tell them apart except for Hasho. Yes. And then I knew that there were a set of twins. I didn't really catch their names kind of thing. So I wish they were more individuals than a group.
I loved that her and Hasho were close because, you know, they had a lot of siblings. They're going to be closer to some than others. But I kept being like, don't say anything because you know it's going to be Hasho that dies. It's going to be your favorite brother.
Yeah.
I was like waiting for him to die. I'm glad he never did.
Okay. <too. laughs> I need to ask, how did you think that the bull broke? Because I'm still confused about that, about why her speaking didn't.
It broke so that she could use her magic to not burn at the stake.
But isn't that just a plot hole?
It's the curse was made with love and the love allowed it to be broken so that she could save her life.
because it was made to protect her. So if it was no longer protecting her, it broke.
Got it.
So yeah.
I think it made sense. Like how it was explained. It did briefly feel like a cop out, but I don't think it was.
See, it confused me. So that's why I was like, wait, what? It didn't make any sense to me. Now you've explained it, it makes more sense. But I felt like the last few pages, like 40 pages, were really rushed at the ending. So I was like, wait, what?
Right. Like Casey said, the bowl was there to protect her, basically, so people wouldn't know where she was and hunt her down and kill her. But at that point, like, she was about to die anyway. It was no longer protecting her.
Yeah. I do agree, though, that the ending is like a lot. Like, the ending is like boom, 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 boom. And Raikum is here and she's saving the day. And Shuri has to make a last minute escape out of the pits of a hell mountain. And I was like, oh my God. Like, it was everything at once.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's not the big bad. Oh, we haven't even met the big bad. Here's the big bad. Oh, wait. But it's actually this big bad within the big bad. And you're like, what the heck? And then, like you said, and then they're like crawling out of the pits of hell with a string. And I was like, wait a second.
And Shiori suddenly, like, her blood could, like, release all the demons.
Yeah.
I feel like we should, like, do a series, like, explain the plot badly. And it's like, girl with bull on head follows string out of hell. Like, birds fly to her aid.
Yeah. Or, like, princess becomes ugly, is silenced, wanders around until almost unleashing devils from hell.
Girl likes soup so much, sticks bowl to your head. Sorry.
Fraught stepdaughter stepmother relationship results in brother's death and burning at the stake.
That is true. There's some Salem shit in here too.
Yeah, because magic is very forbidden, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. This sounds like AI generated summaries, TBH.
Yeah, it does.
Dragon appears in puddle to girl with bowl on head.
There's sexy tension. And then he disappears
in a horse bucket.
Yeah.
Anyway, so while Shuri has the bowl on her head and is at the island, and it's kind of put in the book that you're like, okay, A, this is getting long. B, is she ever getting off this damn island? She meets Takan, but she thinks it's like this other guy. But anyway, you get that this guy has really good vibes, you know, like he's gonna be a good guy. Did you think it was gonna end up being him? Did you like the relationship? Do you like how she ended up at his castle no matter what?
Yes. So I kind of like the themes of fate throughout the book, where Shuri's like, I own my own fate, but you can also sort of feel the world moving around them almost. I feel like that's very fairy tale to have like a balance of fate and free will at play. And so I feel like her journey with Takan kind of creates that, because they meet and you kind of wonder if they're going to end up like going off together, and then they don't, and then they sort of end up there anyway, and you're like, oh, okay. And I liked that. But the whole time I was like, this is the betrothed, like, obviously, like, and they're gonna be a thing.
Yeah. And they even discuss in like when towards the end, they kind of discuss together that their fates are tied together, or their strings are tied mm-hmm. together. And there's a lot of allegory into that idea. Like, I think that's super interesting. I will say it's a very teenage thing to say of like, I have my own free will. Fuck fate. It's like, this is the most teenage angst I've ever heard.
Yeah, I liked the fate thing too. That was a big draw for me and why I ended up liking the kind of predictable romance. Mm-hmm. You know, boy likes girl despite not knowing who she really is, Cinderella kind of thing.
Yes.
I did enjoy their relationship and how she just kind of, it was always going to be him. And
yeah,
I thought it was kind of wholesome. I was going to say something else, but I forgot what it was.
That it was cute.
I literally was sitting here going, don't say cute. Don't say cute. Don't say cute. But I didn't say it.
That's what you were going to say, though.
It is cute, though. It was. It was.
No, it I mean, it identifiably is. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So this officially brings us to the end. Takan, her brothers, and her stepmother work together to fight the wolf, who turns out to be the big bad. Then Reikama dies. You find out that she was the one with Shiori the whole time, which actually did close what I thought was maybe going to be a potential plot hole. Because the whole time I was like, how does she have so many memories of her mother who died when she was like an infant? And then I was like, oh, that makes sense. And so then upon all of this happening, Shiori is tasked with returning Reikama's pearl to the dragons. What did you think of all that?
I was confused about how she got the pearl in the first place. That to me still didn't totally click. Like, your sister was born with a dragon's pearl, but it actually belongs to a dragon. And then I was confused. I didn't hate it. And I liked that she felt so bound by her promise that she wanted to act on it.
Mm-hmm.
The more I read the second book, I'm like, stupid girl, stay home. But it was a nice little segue into, I believe this is a duology, so into like the next, the final book. And I don't know, I like learning things about Reikama at the end and how it kind of brought Shiori to her knees, the reality of what her situation was. And she had no idea because she was too stubborn and pigheaded to see what was going on and how it grew her up. I still don't think she's ready for marriage, despite all the growth, but you know.
No.
Not at all, at all. So I agree. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's still officially 17, but now instead of being 12, she's like 14. Like,
still not marrying age.
Yeah.
It's fantasy for a reason.
Okay.
Not my fantasy.
Yeah, no for me.
That's what I'm saying. It's not realistic.
It's already a stretch for me to get behind 21-year-olds marrying ancient fae. And that's as far as I'm willing to go. Okay, so I agree that I didn't totally understand Reikama's thing with the pearl, but I was kind of hoping it would become more clear in the second book. So I kind of gave the first book a pass on it. Obviously, I don't know how that turns out.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of like alludes to the fact that like it was kind of an ancient thing stolen by her family like a while ago is kind of what it made it seem like, but maybe not. Like, it wasn't well explained. No, I'm hoping that that gets also closed out in the second book. Caitlin's making faces, so I'm guessing it doesn't.
I'm still slightly confused, 75% in on that specific item.
Cool. But I like that it brings the dragons back.
Yeah. Yes, bring back the dragons. Hooray.
Yeah, yeah.
But then that, like, the
little tension of Sari looking at Takan, like,
no. No,
mm-hmm. It was so funny because I find Sari to be this like sassy little brat, and I was kind of mm-hmm. like, of course he's gonna be like, so this is him.
Yeah,
I read that and I was like, God, it's gonna be a love triangle. Stop.
Hey, why can't you have one at land and one at sea, you know?
I doubt a YA book is going to endorse polyamory.
they don't call it the best of both worlds for no reason.
Hey, I'm yeah.
You heard it here first. Caitlin endorses polygamy.
Only if they live in different atmospheres.
Yeah. It would be ethical polyamory if everyone's on board. Very modern.
To be clear, when I see people have that in their like dating bio online, I'm like, whoop, no. So to be clear. If I don't just cut this all out anyway.
Yeah, I'm not judging. I agree. I just think that would be a lot for little Shiori, who is still effectively 12.
Yeah. I like Saryu as a friend. Can't we have male and female friendships?
Yes. Okay. That's my other thing. There's not enough friendships that don't have sexual tension. Men and women can be friends, and let's just leave it at that. Okay. I think that's the end of our discussion. That's literally it. We're gonna end on a rant about the love triangle.
But we are bringing back something very important we keep forgetting to do in recent books, because we were on an SJM train for a bit and it became a stupid question. Books would you recommend to someone who maybe liked this book, maybe wanted something a little different? Either way, what would you recommend?
It's so hard to do book recommendations because I cannot read enough to keep up with having new recommendations for this podcast.
I will say my initial thought was this feels very much like a younger kid version of Priory of the Orange Tree.
So yes. Y'all are going to hate me. In my review, because I did not like Priory, I said this book is what Priory wanted to be.
I mean, I don't disagree. I think if you want the more adult version of this, there's dragons with pearls and love triangles and traveling and curses. And dragons
that probably should have been more important.
Also true. They're there.
Yeah.
They both draw on like fairy tales and east, like far east, ancient items. That was a terrible way to word that, but you know what I mean.
This book is also hard for me, so I feel like I want to do a reverse recommendation. Like I've seen Daughter of the Moon Goddess a lot, and I think that Six Crimson Cranes is a better version of what Daughter of the Moon Goddess was hoping to do, and so yeah, I don't know. Can we do that? Can we do a recommendation or a reverse recommendation?
I think that's fine. I think that's a fair, like, let people know what they might be interested in or not interested in based on this book.
Yeah, it's Daughter of the Moon Goddess is not YA, but it's also like a very clean story. But I just felt like Six Crimson Cranes did like the whole inspired retelling with twists and turns better.
Yeah.
So for your TikTok recommendations, read this one instead of that one.
Read this one instead of Priory.
Amen. It takes 1% of the time.
It does take 1% of the time, even though it's still 455 pages. So it's still a little hefty, even though
it feels like it was like 250 though.
It does.
Yeah.
It feels short.
Yeah. So we've already recommended Graceling before. I think it's very similar-esque vibe to Graceling. Then except another
Graceling is like explicit.
I know. It's hard. I don't read a lot of YA. Why I'm having troubles here.
I want people to know that by similar vibe, you don't mean cute. Like
I don't mean cute. I mean like fairy tale.
Yes. Yes,
it ancient is medieval fantasy. Yeah. Yes. And then I've read a book that recently called Kingdom of the Cursed. It's been on Book Talk a fair amount. It's also adult. There is a fair amount of sex. Not in the first book, but in the second and third. Yes. But it has to do with the seven deadly sins, and this witch who basically, she lives in Sicily in the 1800s, and her sister gets murdered, and she's trying to investigate her twin sister's murder, and she accidentally ties her soul to one of the seven deadly sins. And it's their kind of journey through murder mystery of her sister. So it's kind of similar-esque in like fantasy, but also like fate and the tying of fate. Yeah, but this book is hard to compare anything to.
I thought of one that's not Priory of the Orange Tree. And it's not like super similar. It's just the same kind of princess in dire situation kind of vibe, fairy tale vibe. I read this at the end of last year. It's called Grimrose Girls, and it's a series. I didn't pick up any of the following ones. It wasn't like my favorite, but I wasn't mad I read it. But it's basically all these like princesses or women, like girls who have high powered families, and boys, there are boys there too, are sent to like in a rich academy, and they're kind of figuring out that some of them have similar storylines to princesses in like grim fairy tales, and we're going to die grim deaths, and they're like trying to figure all this out. It was kind of interesting. It was like the darker side of fairy tales again, curses and things. So I would recommend it more so to like a teen who's into this kind of genre, but that's a recommendation.
Nice.
More people die in that book.
All right. Well, good job, guys. Our regular disclaimer, these are just our opinions. We'd love to hear your opinion. Rate and review this podcast, and also hit us up at Busy Girls Pod on almost all social media.
Yeah, so that's pretty much it. I'm Caitlin.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Catherine. Thanks for listening. And when you get a chance, take a break with the Busy Girls Book Club.